Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I'm LZ Granderson, and this is Life Out Loud. From the very first episode of this podcast with Stephen Canals, co-creator of the Emmy Award-winning show, Pose. So, Miss Stephanie, never knew love like this before. Where did that come from? Why that song?
Well, that was a Ryan Murphy suggestion.
To the very last episode of season two, which was just released a couple of months ago with Grammy winner Tracy Young.
You know, I would take people on that journey. I'd give them the ups, the downs, the hills, the valleys. When you play for 12 hours, you've got to tell a story.
The one thing that should be clear to all of y'all who listen to Life Out Loud is that we love us some music. In fact, my producer Trevor Hastings and I, we were both in bands, so the episodes with musicians tend to hold a special place in our hearts. And not just the divas, though we do love our divas. Our conversation with Rufus Wainwright remains one of my favorite, if for no other reason than to hear his Judy Garland stories.
And she was a total rebel, total rock and roll, loved dirty jokes, and was no shrinking violet.
You know, when I think about all of the quote-unquote normal things I missed during the COVID shutdown, not going to concerts might be number one. For me, live music not only connects an artist to her fans, but it connects the artist's fans with each other. For 2 to 3 hours, all of our differences just sort of melt away. And that the only thing that matters is the love we all have for the music that we hear. It lifts. It inspires. It can provide us with a glimpse of what we could be. It can be a reminder of what we once were. To this day, when I hear the first four lines of Iris by the Goo Goo Dolls, I'm transported back to Sons and Daughters, this cute little queer coffee shop in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and the day I met the man who would eventually become my very first boyfriend as an openly gay man.
You're the closest to heaven that I'll ever be, and I don't wanna go home right now.
Then he cheated on me. Next thing I know, Cher's Believe was in heavy rotation, and well, like I said, music has the power to bring us all together. Life Out Loud turns 1 year old this month, and we are all so grateful for each and every one of you who have been there for us. When I originally pitched this idea to ABC back in 2020, I was just hoping for a season. Now we're planning the launch of season 3. Not only that, we've made several best of lists and even won a GLAAD award in our first year of existence. It's been such a wonderful experience, and we look forward to the next chapter. Especially me. I know I've grown a lot as a gay man from these conversations, and I'm curious to see where season 3 leads me. Speaking of looking forward to things, on this special episode of Life Out Loud, we wanted to highlight a couple of queer projects we all are looking forward to. We already know about the tragedies, such as the mass shootings in Texas and in Buffalo. We know about the legislative challenges and the growing concern that the Supreme Court may overturn marriage equality. It's a lot, like a lot. But discrimination can't be the only thing worth talking about, and we are more than a collective pain. In Pride Month is the time of year to recharge our batteries and remember to love. Love one another and love yourself. We gotta remember to love ourselves. So with that, the rom-com movie Fire Island starring Joakim Booster and Bowen Yang has plenty of humor and heart and hot guys. Shout out to you, Conrad Rickamora.
I have a lot of friends, actually. I'm a very fun-loving person.
Really?
Yep.
But what I love most about the film is the intelligent way in which it explores intersectionality without being preachy.
Listen, I know you all think I'm some old, ridiculous burnout, but I had a whole life before I met you, and it used to look a lot like yours. I had lovers and friends. Summers in Cherry Grove with lesbians my own age, and I thought I had it all figured out.
Babe, I know all your stories.
Yes, the fun ones. I tried to fix everyone, but what I was doing is over time, slowly pushing everyone I cared about out of my life until My only friends were a group of boys half my age who only put up with me because I have a house on Fire Island.
That's not true. We love you.
That's sweet.
We speak with the film's director, Andrew Ahn, about creating queer content, being Asian in the LGBTQ plus community, and his thoughts on being pigeonholed. And then we speak with my friend Robbie Rogers, who made the successful transition from history-making soccer star to TV and film producer. He stops by to talk about his period drama, My Policeman, starring the oh-so-talented Harry Styles, as a closeted police officer caught in a love triangle. Do with that information what you will. Anyway, the film comes out in August, but the trailer isn't set to be released for a few more weeks, which is why we can't play a clip for you now. But Robbie does talk a lot about what it's like working with Mr. Styles, so that's definitely worth sticking around for. Trust. But first, my conversation with Fire Island director Andrew Ahn. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, how's it going?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. I'm so excited to speak with you. Thank you so much for making time. First of all, congratulations on making just such a beautiful film with heart.
Thank you.
I've had a chance to watch it. I cried. Oh. And it's just a beautiful film outside of just the sort of the historic nature of this film. And so I think my first question for you would be, you know, what's the trick to balancing somewhat unexplored social justice conversations with humor, right? The explored ones have a chance to have humor, right? Because we've been talking about it, but the unexplored, what's the trick?
Yeah, you know, I was really inspired by Joel Kim Booster's screenplay because I felt like it was such a great Trojan horse for, you know, really difficult, important subjects within the queer community wrapped up in the package of a rom-com, you know? I loved how it explored, you know, racism and classism, you know, even kind of desirability and body politics. I think Joel and I both really wanted to explore those themes through story and character. We never wanted it to be pedantic, you know, so we really tied it to these characters in a way that allowed these themes to be really organic.
Private Instagram, it's like, what's he hiding?
We know his name is Charlie, and he's got a dog emoji and a plant emoji and a stethoscope emoji. What a riddle.
Okay, we're gonna have to solve that later because we're gonna start leaving it. What are you doing? No.
But yeah, you know, I wanted to lean into those themes and also lean into the humor and not be afraid of either of them. And I think it's that fearlessness that allowed the film to feel like a really great balance of these two elements.
It was absolutely fearless. I love the way that you casually talked about prep. I love the way that, you know, because, you know, so often, especially in television, you know, it's a whole episode.
Yeah.
And they make this big production out of it, and it's sort of like, this has kind of been around for a while, you know, let's stop making it like this, you know, mystical pill that we know nothing of, you know.
So I know.
I love that part.
Thank you. Yeah, I love that, like, we don't explain what it is, because, you know, it's like we really wanted this to be for, you know, the queer community, and it didn't feel right to explain that joke. But, you know, it's like, if someone doesn't know what it is, it's easy enough to, you know, to look it up. Like, I think you can't make something for everyone. You know, you can only make something that is inspired by, you know, your personal experiences and hope that people find elements of it that resonate with them.
One of the other aspects of the film that I love, that I really related to, because it felt like for Black people, one of the things that offend a lot of us is when random white strangers try to touch our hair. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a total invasion of space, right? But it happens all the time. And one of the things that sort of I correlated that to was in your film, when people, particularly this one character that was like a rice queen, was trying to like say, hey, are you this? Hey, are you that? And it was like, almost like he was on a game show.
Hey,
howdy.
Oh, God. Hi.
Couldn't help notice you looking at me earlier.
No, I wasn't looking
at Moses.
You.
I'm Moses. Are you Korean?
You look Korean.
I have a sense. Let me get your drink.
Oh, no. My boyfriend here, and he's gonna
gonna grab it for us.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand what's going on.
Honey, are you Filipino? You look Filipino.
I'm gonna go.
Yeah. Do you find similarities in that, or do you think it's like a totally different strand of where that sort of entry into a person's space comes from?
I think that moment in the film that you describe, it's something that's happened to me. You know, it's something that's happened to Joel. You know, I think it's really interesting whenever I've seen that scene with an audience, the queer Asian Americans will laugh really hard. I think that there's something about how we've been perceived that I feel like the Asian American community, the queer Asian American community, like, hasn't been a part of. And so it feels really great in this film to be an author, you know, to control the narrative and to let us describe who we are instead of letting others. And so I'm really thankful that I was hired to direct this film, that I got to collaborate with Joel Kim Booster and, you know, many other queer Asian Americans so that we could tell something that really felt like it was for us, by us.
How have you grown or changed since Spa Night to Fire Island as a director?
I've become more curious about...
You seem pretty curious in Spa Night.
That's a good point. You know, I'll say, like, I think with Spa Night, I was still figuring out, like, my voice as a filmmaker, and I definitely knew what I wanted to say then, but I didn't necessarily know how I wanted to navigate the rest of my career. With something like Fire Island, which is so different from my previous works, I feel like I'm understanding at least my path in the near future, which is that I want to explore different genres. I want to try different things as a director. I don't want to be afraid of something that I haven't done before, you know? And so in the way that Fire Island is my first rom-com, you know, I hope to, you know, maybe do an action film or do, you know, a horror movie. I think I'll always go back to, you know, really intimate dramas. That's what I really love as a filmmaker, but I think I want to have fun with my career. I want to try different things. I think that's the only way to stay fresh in this art form and, you know, keep learning.
One of the things I also loved about the film, in addition to the relationships, and I had an opportunity to have Margaret Cho on as a guest in season two of the podcast, and she talked about the family aspect of it. But there's also natural beauty that you captured in the film. You know, those of us who've been to Fire Island, we all know that it's a picturesque place, and you captured it beautifully. How many of the moments in the film were purposely designed just to show off how gorgeous the island is?
I made it a priority to just show the beauty of the natural landscape there. You know, I think that's part of its allure. I think that's part of what makes that experience so special, is that you're out in nature. You've got the wind and the waves and, you know, the deer. I remember telling my cinematographer, I told my cinematographer, I was like, I need the deer. I really want the deer. I know that they're like covered in ticks, but it's okay. But I was really committed to, you know, showing as many different parts of the island as I could. And so, you know, we had a really great camera team that was going around, you know, capturing really interesting sights and moments on the island. I'm really thankful for my cinematographer, Felipe Varderay, for really, you know, just capturing the island in all its glory.
Yeah, I thought you did a fantastic job. Rest of the summer, what are you working on and what are you looking forward to?
Yeah, I'm really excited for this cast. Joel Kim Booster has a really exciting month ahead of him. You know, this movie, he has his Netflix special. He has his Apple TV show, Loot, with Maya Rudolph. I am super excited for Matt Rogers, who has a show, I Love That For You, on Showtime. I'm just so excited for this next generation of queer talent, you know? And so that's what I'll be watching. You know, in terms of what I'll be making, I'm, you know, working on some screenplays, Asian American queer stories. Definitely, it's always going to be a part of who I am as a filmmaker.
Do you feel obligated?
You know, it's so interesting that you asked that. I know a lot of people think that, you know, it's like, oh, like, am I afraid of getting pigeonholed, you know, as just like doing queer Asian American things? And my answer to that is, I say, like, I love my hole, you know, like it is it's made me who I am as a filmmaker. You know, I don't feel the need to have to stray from that in order to grow in my career. Instead, can I like grow with the stories? And so the fact that I got to direct Fire Island, it feels like a great sign that queer Asian American stories can be financed at the, you know, highest levels. I'm gonna keep pushing on that. Nothing I can say specifically yet, but hopefully some exciting things coming very shortly.
You know, I'm so glad that you talked about, you know, feeling pigeonholed and quote unquote, what does that really mean, especially as a creative, right? Because I find that people who use that word or that term are actually outside looking in.
Yeah.
That those of us that are on the inside, we don't feel trapped because we understand there's a wealth of stories here and that we can tell these stories for forever and a day. And it reminded me of a moment that Toni Morrison had during an interview that has gone viral. The great author was talking about being seen as mainstream. Mm. And she challenged the notion of what it meant to be mainstream, because so often it comes from a white perspective, right? Like once white people like it, then you're mainstream. No matter how many millions of people of color might be supporting something, it isn't mainstream until it's perceived to be, you know, something that white people are into. Yeah. And so I'm really glad that you talked about that as a director. My question is, you still need white people to come to your stuff. Like, if you really want to, like, you know, break it big in terms of, you know, tens of millions of dollars gross, you still need white eyeballs. So how do you balance that?
Yeah, you know, I think it's really important for me as a filmmaker to not define success in terms of box office or how many eyeballs are seeing it, you know, because I think that that feels, it's really capitalistic, right? Like, and I ultimately care most about, you know, like who are the people watching? Who are the people that are finding this and is it meaningful to them, you know? You know, I think it's part of the way that we have to reimagine like what success means to us so that we can reach a more equitable like media representation. I'm going to do my best as a filmmaker to not worry about whiteness, because I think as soon as I do, I've fallen into a system that is going to disadvantage me.
Makes a lot of sense. Let's talk about something messy, shall we?
Yeah.
A memory from Fire Island that you can share on ABC.
No, of course. I love that we got to spend, you know, 2 weeks on the island together. The cast and I stayed in a house together, which was so special, you know, and it really felt like...
Like who? Like, because it's a fairly large cast, so who are we talking?
Yeah, we had Joel, Bowen, Margaret, Conrad, James, Torian, Tomas, you know.
Sounds like the real gay world.
It was a full house, yeah. I loved, you know, seeing Tomas trying on some of Margaret's clothes, you know, and Margaret gifted Tomas, you know, some of her, like, special items. You know, I was going to bed one night and my room shared an air vent with Joel's room, and I heard him watching Real Housewives of Beverly Hills with some of the other castmates, and I could hear them giggle and, you know, having fun. You know, I think there's something about how we created a chosen family from this cast that mirrors the chosen family in the movie. And even if the movie was terrible, the fact that we had that time on the island, the fact that we forged life-lasting friendships, like, that to me made the process of working on this film so worth it.
Well, again, it's a tremendous success. I hope, you know, people see it again and again and again and again. I definitely will. Andron, thank you so much for joining us here on Life Out Loud.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
I first heard the name Robbie Rogers when he came out in 2013, becoming the first openly gay man to compete in a big North American sports league.
I think I knew I was gay when I was about 14.
He knew he had to hide those feelings if he ever wanted to pursue his dream. And by the time Rogers made it to the big leagues, he was living in constant fear.
I'm just having the feeling that I hope no one figures out I'm gay.
Since then, a lot has changed. He's won a soccer championship with the LA Galaxy, became a father, and after retiring from soccer, became a film and television producer working alongside his husband, Greg Berlanti. In addition to producing his forthcoming film, My Policeman, Robbie is also a producer for CW's All American.
Here I was thinking the university was being inclusive, only to find out you made it all happen. So I wouldn't have to encounter ignorance from dorm mates in the communal bathroom.
I just wanted you to feel safe and comfortable.
Robbie even had a role himself in Love, Simon, which his husband, Greg, directed. He and I had chatted in a while, so of course I had to ask him, how was the family? Robbie, before we get into producing queer content for networks and, you know, streaming services and etc., you and I need to do a catch up because the last time that we saw each other, you weren't even a parent yet.
True.
So what's going on with the babies, right? Caleb and Mia?
Yes. Caleb, our son, is 6, and our daughter, Mia, is going to be 3 this year. They're in school. They are like siblings in such a stereotypical way. They like love and hate each other, which has actually been, you know, as they get older, they become sweeter and sweeter and more supportive of each other, which has been really nice to watch. And actually, an interesting thing that's happened over the pandemic, because they've had to spend so much time with each other because we took them out of school at the height of the pandemic for about a year, was they really, just because they spent so much time together, they really bonded. They get to play a lot together. She parrots a lot of pretty much everything he does. And I think that, you know, she really, really adores him, and he kind of at times puts up with her. But they've really connected, I would say, over the last year and a half.
That is so lovely. Now, obviously, you know, you are a former professional athlete, and usually at some point or another, the parent who was a former professional athlete tries to introduce their child to their sport. We see Serena Williams doing it. She posts a lot of videos online. Obviously, LeBron James in the city, you know, Bronny. Are you doing that with Caleb and Mia? Are you trying to get them to play soccer?
No, I mean, it's Caleb is playing soccer and Mia does kick the soccer ball around the house, but no, I say that and I say no. I am the parent when at Caleb's soccer games that literally sits in a chair and stays silent. Like I think a lot of the parents are like, oh, you should, you know, help coach. And, you know, I just, obviously we introduce them to all these things, whether it's music and dance and sports. And so we do all of that, but I don't want to put any pressure on them. And, you know, I watch soccer on the weekends. I'm a huge Arsenal fan, and sometimes they'll sit with me and watch the game, and Caleb's super competitive with me. So whatever team Arsenal is playing against, he'll always like start rooting for them. It's pretty funny. He knows exactly. He'll be like, I'm a Liverpool fan. I'm like, oh, really? Okay. So he definitely, you know, he like grabs a knife and twists it. There are moments where he's like, I want to be like you, Data R. He calls me Data R and Greg Data G. He's like, I want to be like you, Data R. I want to be a professional soccer player. I'm like, okay, well then this weekend, let's go out in the backyard and let's just start training and working on technique. And we'll do that. And then literally after 20 minutes, he's usually like, eh, let's go read a book or let's go do an art project. Like he's, I think in his mind, he's like torn between like wanting to be into sports, but then realizing that he's not that into sports.
So switching gears for a second, you know, your second act, if you will, is just as powerful as your first act. And I guess my first question for you, as we're talking about queer content for television and streaming services and film, is how much of Robbie the athlete is instrumental in Robbie the producer's success?
I would say very influential. I think, I mean, you know this, but athletes are incredibly driven, stubborn, single-minded, passionate. There are moments in a season where you are really failing and you have to find a way to win games, to play through injuries, just not to quit on your team, your teammates, yourself. You know, and have to find a way to be a success. And so I've taken that into producing and writing. You know, I am optimistic that I'm going to get a green light or that someone's going to like a script. And I believe in projects. I think my main job, you know, is to believe in projects before anyone else does. So, you know, All American, I was extremely passionate about it. And, you know, I kind of didn't ever think no was a reality, that, you know, was going to somehow will this into existence, that it should be a show, that it was an important show, that it was entertaining, that it could be a huge success. And I was a bit naive, but I also really believed all those things. And, you know, I think a lot of athletes, we really have a lot of confidence from a young age and believe in ourselves. And so a lot of the characteristics I had as an athlete, and I think a lot of athletes have, I've used that in the way I produce. So I think being an athlete really prepared me to be a producer and now writing. You know, it really helped me. There are things that have not helped me. I think athletes were very impatient. You know, it's like every day you have training, and when you lose a game, you get ready for the next game and you got to win the next game. And, you know, as a producer and as a writer, it's like waiting for someone to read a script, waiting for someone to green light something, waiting for a deal to get done that you're just like trying to crank out. Like that stuff's all, you know, I have a lot of growth in that area to find patience with people. But for the most part, like so many things, you know, and if I were, you know, hiring at a you know, large company, I'd want to find athletes because I just, you know, I know how it's helped me and my friends now that are all retiring and moving into like the workforce, let's say, are having a lot of success because how it shapes them from a young age to be an athlete, to be on a team. Again, for all the reasons I said, I think it really helps you move into your second chapter, as you call it.
You know, it's interesting that you said that, you know, if you started a company, you would want to find athletes because All American was, you know, brought to you by an athlete, Super Bowl winning champion Spencer Paysinger, who's a buddy of mine, who's absolutely lovely. He's a wonderful person. Is that how you, you know, connected on All American, is knowing that there's, you know, this athlete there that you can connect with and bond with?
Yeah. So I met Spencer through my friend Dane Mork, and they came to me kind of with like Spencer's life. And there were definitely elements that I couldn't quite like, you know, totally relate to. I'm from Palos Verdes. He's from, you know, Crenshaw. But there were so many aspects of his life that I really found very emotional and relatable to myself, and that I thought that the country and the world could relate to.
Like what?
You know, him trying to be both an athlete and a young adult at Beverly Hills High School when he like felt like an outsider. You know, I felt like that all of my career. I felt like, okay, I have these dreams of an athlete, but I don't quite fit in the locker room. I don't quite fit in, you know, at Modern Day when I, you know, knew I was a closeted young gay man. And I was at a Catholic school where no one around me was gay. None of the athletes were gay. All my role models, who I wanted to mimic my career after, none of them were out professional athletes. So I really related to his story of being an outsider and having these dreams for himself and just the obstacles of them and not totally understanding how he was going to get there, but that he had the passion and the desire to do it. Like, that's kind of how I was.
Yo, coach, look, I'm just motivating them, all right? These guys don't get it.
Shut up and listen for once, okay? They don't hit, I can't evaluate their weaknesses and fine tune them.
You want to know their weaknesses? I spent the last week working with these guys. The weakness is not one of them got the ability to take their game to the next level. Not one. You lost your best players when your starters were suspended. And the only person left seemingly worth anything is Santiago. And his ass is inconsistent in the box because he lets his emotions control the game. What are we doing?
Each one of these guys has like an interesting story. All of them feel that they don't totally belong. Maybe some feel they belong more than others, but you know, different religions, different racial backgrounds, different economic backgrounds from different countries, like everything. And I realized like each one of these guys, we're all very different, and all of our differences really make us like a strong team when we're all, when we can all, you know, find some way to sync together. And I thought Spencer's story, people would find it relatable around the world and around the United States. And I think I'm right. I think it's a very diverse show, and I think a very diverse audience watches this show, because I mean, a lot of people that watch it don't even like football. They just really love going through Spencer's life and his relationships and his family, the family drama, and they want him to succeed just as they want to succeed themselves. And I just found myself, you know, getting sucked in more and more and more to his story and his path, and then finding like, oh wow, I really understand this emotional journey in a way that like is different for me, but there are definitely similarities.
I think it's one of the reasons why the X-Men series has mm-hmm. so many queer fans, is because we can relate to what it means to be born a certain way, different and mm-hmm. feared because of that difference. And, you know, I was going to ask you, you know, did you feel an obligation to have your first creative project of this nature be centered around a queer character, but it seems as if you found a degree of queerness outside of just sexual orientation and gender identity that you connected with.
Yes, I think it is. It's like the feeling of being like other, right? Feeling of being just like an outsider. That's where I really, really connected. On a smaller scale, it was like Spencer's journey. And then on a larger scale, it was like these two worlds clashing, and like perhaps I think a lot of America now is like so many like pointing fingers of we're different this way, we're this, we vote differently, we look different, and like, but what are our similarities? I think we're always, like I said, trying to find like what makes us different. And I thought there was something beautiful in, yes, exploring those, but also like what are the great things about us that make us the same, and where can we find common ground, you know? So it is an interesting way. It is like it is an outsider story, you know, for me, who is and I'm sure like you have, we've like, you know, been outsiders on a lot of fields and in a lot of rooms.
Speaking of outsiders, 1950s Brighton, a gay policeman named Tom marries a school teacher named Marion while in a relationship with Patrick. How in the heck did you find My Policeman, and where are you with production?
I was living in England, and I was just coming out to some people. I'd come out to my family. It was 2012. And one of my friends who was like kind of helping me, you know, I hadn't come out publicly yet, but he was answering questions for me of, you know, these people are reaching out to me, should I say anything? Or, you know, what happens if someone writes something in a paper? He was like a publicist, and he was just kind of helping to guide me through any kind of questions I had. And he's like, oh, this publishing house wants to meet with you, and so they want you to do a book. And I was like, well, I'm not going to do a book, but okay, I'll go meet with them. So I met with them, and they, you know, had their spiel of why I should do a book with them. And again, I had no plan to, but they at the end were like, oh, you should read this book. It's really beautiful. It's called My Policeman, and you should just take a look. And so I took it, and that weekend I actually was supposed to go run the Brighton Half Marathon. And I had this book, and so I read My Policeman, you know, taking place in Brighton. I think I read it in like 2 days, and then I was down in Brighton. And it's just like, I fell in love with it. It was just such a beautiful book. And you know, when I brought it back home with me, I started dating Greg, and I was reading, I think I was reading again for the third or fourth time. And I kind of told him about this book, how beautiful it was, the love triangle, the mystery, you know, just the love story. And so he read it and he was like, oh my God, this is so beautiful. We should listen to a movie. And so we did. And so we optioned it. We found Ron Nicewander, you know, Michael Grandage. We cast it with Harry Styles, Emma Corrin, David Dawson, Linus Roach, Rupert Everett, and Gina McKee, amongst others. And we shot it, this last summer, 2021. And it's coming out, you know, Q4 of this year. And it's really, really beautiful. You know, the whole team, the director, the cast has done an incredible job. And it's at Amazon. They've been extremely supportive. And it's just a really, really beautiful, painful story, very cathartic, about love and not being able to control love. And we've wrapped and it will come out this year. I'm really, really excited. It's a beautiful, important, powerful film that I can't wait for you to see.
What was it like working with Harry Styles, who obviously is a big star, but also someone who really plays a lot in terms of gender representation and presentation and being such a tremendous ally? What was it like just going through this process with him?
You know, before working with Harry, I had heard so many great things about who he is as a person, you know, very authentic and kind and giving and just very talented. But it wasn't really until I started to work with him when I work with him on set. I mean, he is all those things. He's extremely talented. I mean, it's just almost not fair, you know, such a young age to be both like gifted, you know, a true artist, you know, like a real artist that isn't doing it, you know, just to be like this hipster. Like he actually is a real artist that has deep feelings about, you know, his character and the movie and in his music, you know, his storytelling. So it was really just, he was so genuine. It was just such a relief to be able to work with an actor who's both talented and kind and respectful and respectful to everyone on set, you know, his fellow castmates, the director, to, you know, the PAs, like just to everybody. It was very refreshing. So he really did such a great job in this film and is just very authentic. You know, I know people are always trying to like solve who Harry is. And I think he's exactly who he tells you and shows you who he is. Like, he's not doing anything, you know, for a brand or to play with people. Like, I mean, in my experience, you know, I'm just speak from my experience. He really is just a very authentic, pure person, which, it was such a relief. You know, there's so many guys that you work with, I mean, even in sports, that like, you know, show one face and say one thing, but are another person in the locker room, or actors who pretend to be someone and then they are not. You know, he really is exactly who he is, who he presents to the world, which I found so refreshing and so rare in this world.
You have another project that I read about called The Dallas Sting. What is that about?
Oh yeah, this is super cool. I'm excited. So we have been developing this project about the Dallas Sting, which is the first women's world championship team. China invited, it was like four or five women's teams. I think it was in the 70s to China to play in this tournament. And the problem was there was no US women's team. US soccer was just a men's team then. And like barely, no, I'm kidding. No, but there was no US team for the women. So what they did was like US soccer went around and tried to like invite, you know, the best college teams or the best, they tried to like put a team together, and everyone said no. Like everyone was like in their college seasons. Also, they were like, what is this? We're not going to travel to China. Like, but so eventually they go to this girls like under 18 or under 19 club team called the Dallas Sting, you know, in Dallas, Texas. And they were the best under 18 or under 19 team in the nation, and they had been the best for a while. And so they asked them to go, and there was this coach named Bill Kinder who was like much more progressive and much more, you know, supportive of these young women, and he was able to motivate all of them and their families to go to China and to play in this like world championships. And it's about these group of girls who kind of, you know, are living in a country that tells them that they're not equal to the men around them, but that they want them to go represent them, which is like, I find so fascinating. I mean, I found it, I even found it relatable to, like, you know, being a gay man and being a gay man in sports, where, like, for a long time people have said, like, well, you guys can't be in sports. Like, you're not supposed to be in sports. Like, there are none of you. Let's keep it that way. And I think, like, women have had a similar journey of, like, you know, you're not equal when you are playing sports, but, like, so, but we need you to represent us. You know, you can imagine the men's World Cup team, if they won a World Cup, like, what would be waiting for them at the airport? It would be, you know, cameras and, you know, media and who knows what. And these women came back and no one even, you know, raised an eyebrow. So I just found it a very powerful story. And so we're out to directors now, and we're doing this with Skydance, and the girls, that the women that wrote Glow, the TV show, wrote the script. They did an incredible job. So that's a really exciting one to hopefully get to make.
And listen to you talk about these three different projects that you are attacking from three different worldviews. And I can see the through line, but do you think people are able to follow your creative, like, prism, if you will? Like, they don't know what they're going to get from a project you're connected with. Do you like that? Do you seek that?
You know, it's very early on in my producing career. I think that the example that people have, you know, All American is like the first thing that they've watched that I've been a part of. You know, My Policeman will come out this year. The Sting will come out. I also have a project at Showtime called Fellow Travelers, which is a love story between two men that's set in the 50s and the 80s, about they meet in the Lavender Scare, and it ends as one of them is, you know, at the other's at the AIDS quilt in Washington, D.C. One of them's passed away. And I think as more projects that I've been a part of start to come out, I think the through line this is kind of Robbie's brand so far of the content that he wants to put out into the world, I think it'll become more evident. But I know what I want to make. You know I want to make shows and films and work on projects that makes people really feel things, that, you know, help us relate to others in a way that we don't usually, you know, on our daily basis, we don't think about. But I know what my brand is. I know how I want people to feel, and what I want to entertain people, but also hopefully open their eyes a little bit.
What is it like working with your husband, Greg, especially considering he was already established, well established in this industry that you find yourself in now?
If I could always work with Greg, I would. But sometimes it's not possible. You know, sometimes you're working with a writer that's at a different studio that has a contract somewhere else. And I think it's good for me at times not to work with him. It helps me find more belief in myself as a producer. It helps me grow and learn from different people. I value the projects that aren't with Greg and Sarah at Warner Brothers, because, again, I learned so much, and it helps me really establish who I am as a producer away from them. But I love working with them. I love being in an editing bay with Greg. I love being on set with Sarah. I love doing notes with them. We're always very aligned, and it's just, it's more fun. You know, you want to work with people you love. I think we all feel that way.
Robbie Rogers, champion, producer, dad, hubby. Robbie, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this, actually.
Thanks so much, Robbie, again, for spending time with us. And you too, Andrew. I hope everyone sees Fire Island this week and looks forward to seeing My Policeman in August. I know I do. And not just because Harry Styles is in it. Okay, maybe because Harry Styles is in it. Anyway, hey, it's Pride Month. And that means it's our time to once again just kind of recharge, celebrate, and lift one another up. Listen, we all know about the challenges that are out there. The legislative challenges, threats to marriage equality. There's so much on cable news and newspapers and social media that can bring us down and to make us sad, and that's to worry about. And I get all of that. But I also understand that life isn't just about our trauma, and life isn't just about the obstacles. Life is for living and for loving and for celebrating, and especially during Pride. Pride is the time of year in which we're supposed to recharge our batteries and be a source of hope for young people who aren't quite sure if there's a world out there for them. You know, Pride is a time of year in which we show those young people who are in situations where they don't think that life is worth living, that it truly is, and that whatever they're going through, it gets better. I still believe that. We gotta still believe that. That was the hope that Harvey talked about. So, go out there, party safely, love greatly, and live life out loud. Life Out Loud with LG Granderson is a production of ABC Audio, produced by my friend Trevor Hastings. Senior producer is Brenda Salinas Baker. The executive producer of Life Out Loud is Liz Alessi. I'm LZ Granderson.
This is that good.